Science fiction is any idea that occurs in the head and doesn't exist yet. But soon will, and will change everything for everybody, and nothing will ever be the same again. As soon as you have an idea that changes some small part of the world, you are writing science fiction. It's always the art of the possible, never the impossible. It's from Ray Bradbury, considered one of the most influential science fiction writers of his time. From Mary Shelley and Jules Verne to Isaac Asimov and H.G. Wells to Suzanne Collins and James S.A. Corey, writers of science fiction have captured our imaginations for centuries with stories of, as Bradbury put it, the possible. Some told stories of science gone wrong, and some, like our guest, have taken us to distant stars and galaxies far, far away. Central Wisconsin's John Jackson Miller is the New York Times best-selling author of numerous Star Trek and Star Wars novels, including Star Trek Discovery, Die Standing, and Star Wars Kenobi. His latest novel, released this August, Star Trek Picard, Rogue Elements, is quickly becoming a hit among fans. John also spends time in and around the Marvel Universe, as well as tracking the comics industry. Welcome to Route 51. I'm on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rick Ryer. John Jackson Miller, welcome back to Route 51.
Hey, Rick. Glad to be here and be back in studio.
Excellent. John, I'd really like to know, what does your passport really look like?
Well, I joke that the way to get to work in these different tie-in universes is to get your passport stamped. If people ask, well, how did you get to write Star Trek? I'll say, well, because I wrote Star Wars. How'd you get to write Star Wars? Because I had written for Marvel. How'd I get to write for Marvel? I had worked for a comic book magazine for many years. All of these things are about you're showing a licensor that you can use their characters, use their properties, play in their sandbox without ruining things, without coming up with some sort of a story idea that's going to make things more difficult for other writers or embarrass the license.
Well, congratulations on the new book, Star Trek Picard, Rogue Elements. This is fantastic. Please give us a quick sketch.
This is about a character, Cristobal Rios, in the TV series, who's played by Santiago Cabrera. He is a former Starfleet officer who lost his job in mysterious circumstances. And basically, at the point of our novel, which is about 9 years before the TV show, set 9 years before the TV show. He is adrift. He has nothing to do with his life. He arranges to purchase a starship called the La Serena, which he calls the La Serena. And it's a freighter sort of a ship for just carrying things around. And his idea is to just basically sort of crawl in a hole and pull it after him. He has no desire to really do anything. But I confront him with a number of problems. One is the group of people that he bought the starship from. These are characters that we have not really seen in recent years, called the Iotians. Now, these are characters from a TV episode called A Piece of the Action from the original TV series. This is where the folks at Desilu Studios used the props and back lot that they had from the Untouchables TV series to do an episode where Kirk and Spock get to go down to a planet where everybody thinks it's the 1920s in Chicago. It's just a delightful change of pace episode. I wanted to do a story that was rooted in that. And, one of my fun connections to it is I did not see that episode when it aired because I was born the night that it first broadcast.
It's a fascinating ride. In the acknowledgement section of the book, you share not only how you came to write it, but how you wrote it, especially in light of COVID-19. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I when I was approached to write the book, I was asked if there was any particular character I wanted to write about, and I said Rios, and they said, well, that's perfect. That's who we want you to write. And then when I was talking with Kirsten Beyer, who is a co-creator of the TV series, I consult with her on every book that I do that ties in with one of the streaming TV shows. I said, I really want to do a fun book. I want to do a book that has you know, almost no body count, where almost nobody dies. I had just done two books, Enterprise War and Die Standing, which had been kind of bleak. You know, there had been certainly a lot of bad things happening. And I said, you know, this book is going to be a summer read in, you know, when it comes out in August and through the fall and through the holiday season. You know, this is basically, you know, my chance to give readers a break from something dark and depressing. Well, at the same time, it was for me because, again, being shut in Wisconsin over the winter to write a novel is not an unusual thing for me. But you know, usually the reason that I can't go anywhere is because of the weather. I had it doubly this time, and I said, well, as long as I'm going to be locked in and snowed in, let me write something fun.
So really, how much fun was it to write it?
It was an absolute blast. You know, one of the things I was able to do was bring back a character who is an obsessed collector, Akiva Fajo from the TV series. And so books and collecting books and other kinds of physical collectibles are a big element in this whole thing. And so, you know, as somebody who is an obsessive collector myself and, you know, has a career built on, you know, writing about collectible comic books and other things, I was able to sneak a lot of that stuff in there and, you know, joke about it in a 24th century perspective.
There's even one little mention of Wisconsin in the book, but we'll kind of leave that for readers.
Yes, as a yes. I don't do that often, but there it is.
I was surprised to see that. It was great. Now, you have obviously written quite a bit in the Star Trek universe. What pressure do you experience writing in this universe or any other universe of such a seminal sci-fi figure as Gene Roddenberry?
Well, you know, it's something where I try to treat working in Star Trek or Star Wars or, you know, video game you know, franchises that I've worked in, such as Halo and Mass Effect. I try to treat the franchise's you know, property there as a national park. I look at it as, you know, I don't want to leave a lot of footprints where I'm going. I'm not there to get my fingerprints on everything. I'm not there to completely change the way that we understand the characters or that we understand the situations. You know, I'm not there for that reason. I'm there to, you know, sort of take people on a journey through it, you know, let them see some things in a different light. But then I, you know, like if you're backpacking in the forest, you try to take out everything you put in. You don't want to leave a lot of debris lying around. And so, yes, I'm very careful. You know, especially when it comes to, you know, creating a lot of loose story threads that, you know, I might not be able to wrap up myself. And I also don't run around closing off story avenues that other writers might be willing to, you know, fill in one day.
Well, that's really interesting to me because I wanted to ask, what is it like to take a character who really are pretty well known in these universes like Picard or Kenobi and find these new stories and filling in the gaps of knowledge?
Well, you know, you look at them, you figure out what have we not seen before? How have we not actually, you know, what are the kinds of stories that haven't been told? It would be very, very easy just to retell the same story again and again in these tie-in stories, you know, just to have a different Darth person, a different you know, super weapon that destroys planets. Just give it a different name. You know, there's already a book for that. It's called Star Wars Mad Libs, where you fill in the blank. You know, by doing a book, for example, like Kenobi, which is a you know, really a Western, you know, it lets us see the characters in a way that is, you know, it's in keeping with the movie. It's in keeping with what we know about the characters, but it gives us sort of a different spin on them and makes us think about them a little bit differently.
Well, you mentioned the word Western. I'd like to kind of go there for a little bit. I read an interview that you had. I can't remember exactly where who interviewed you, but you talked about the movie Shane.
Yeah.
And how much of an influence that film had on you. Do you see that film influencing your writing today, especially with this book, with Kenobi?
Well, with the Kenobi novel, that actually began with my editor at Dark Horse Comics. It wasn't even a novel at that point. My editor at Dark Horse Comics and I were just pitching back and forth ideas for a possible graphic novel. I had said, you know, we'd landed on Shane, which is the wonderful movie with Alan Ladd as the mysterious stranger who wanders into town, the man with a past, the former gunfighter. Alan Ladd's son, Alan Ladd Jr., actually was one of the producers of the Star Wars movie later on, so there's kind of a connection there. But, you know, this is a great Western, also based on a novel to begin with. And, you know, it was a case where I looked at that and said, well, what is Obi-Wan Kenobi when he arrives on Tatooine, if not the mysterious stranger who wanders into town, a man running away from his past, hiding from who he had to be? So, you know, this is something where, you know, we could take the elements of the Western or of Westerns in general and find a way to make them work in a science fiction context.
Well, how have you, and you mentioned your collaborators, especially in all these universes that you're working in, how do you and other writers keep science fiction relevant?
Well, I think, you know, I try not to do a lot of stuff that is ripped from the headlines necessarily. You know, our job is not to basically do, you know, the sort of a Law and Order procedural where we make it clear that this is something that happened last year on TV that is there. But, you know, you can pull themes from things. You know, when I did a novel called Star Wars: A New Dawn, a lot of it had to do with, because it was a period about the Empire taking over, it had to do with the Empire taking all of the ways that you know, commercial companies in the Republic were tracking people, were advertising to people, were gathering data on people, and then perverting and hijacking that for the purposes of you know, becoming a totalitarian state, as happens in the Empire. So, you know, that's something where, you know, I was able to take some elements of things that were in the news or things that were, you know, concerns in reality, and then put a spin on them. And, you know, it you never want to do something which is just a direct, well, this is something about that. But, you know, that's not uncommon necessarily in science fiction stories. If you go back to the original Star Trek, you know, you can very easily see episodes that they did where it is a really specific allegory to a particular you know, current event.
Mm-hmm. Well, in these stories that you're writing, there are specific timelines that travel through the different universes that you're working in. How do you decide how much fiction is maybe a little bit too over the top for what you're writing? In other words, it's fiction. How believable does it have to be still?
Well, I mean, any franchise that you're in, there are rules sort of how things work. And it's kind of like case law. It's what have you seen before? And so, you know, there'll be questions that will come up where you'll have somebody do something. Can somebody who uses the Force project a thought into somebody whose language they don't speak? That's a very simple story question, but you wonder, well, is there any documentation about that? And then you'll go back and see various moments in the movies where, you know, Luke, for example, you know, is able to communicate with Bib Fortuna, who is the you know, the maitre d' at the Jabba the Hutt residence, and they don't speak the same language. You know, there are other things like that where, you know, you say, okay, here is the precedent for this. This is what I'm hanging this on. And usually that will get it through. You know, you don't want to invent new powers. You don't want to this is one of the things that made Superman comic books so difficult to write for so long is they would invent a new power for the character every single issue.
We're talking with John Jackson Miller, a Central Wisconsin writer who is steeped into the universes of Star Wars, Star Trek, and Marvel, and much, much more. And we'll continue our voyage through the final frontier in just a bit. When we return, we'll look into the intersection of science fiction and science reality and take a deeper dive into Star Trek, Star Wars, and the Marvel universes. Your questions and comments are welcome. Join us by calling 780-970-9742. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. I'm Rick Ryer. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Dave, do you mind if I ask you a personal question?
No, not at all.
I've wondered whether you might be having some second thoughts about the mission.
How do you mean?
Rumors about something being dug up on the moon. I never gave these stories much credence, but particularly in view of some of the other things that have happened, I find them difficult to put out of my mind.
Open the pod bay doors, please, Hal.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
We're back on Route 51.
What are you talking about, Hal?
I'm Rick Ryer.
This conversation concerns...
Welcoming listeners to the West Side. John Jackson Miller is our guest today. What would you like to know about science fiction writing? Are you a fan of John's work? Star Wars, Star Trek, Marvel Universe? Email us at ideas@wpr.org or join by phone. The number to call is 800-780-9742. That was a clip from the classic 2001 A Space Odyssey, a film many scholars and scientists claim is the most scientifically accurate science fiction film ever made. That's according to Vincent Perturo, author of The Science of Sci-Fi Cinema. John, I'm really curious about the intersection between science fiction and science reality. With advances in technology and our expanding knowledge of science and space, how can science fiction continue to stretch our understanding of the current reality?
Well, this is obviously something that, you know, as you note there, has been a part of science fiction for a long while, where you had 2001, that's a great clip there, Arthur C. Clarke. Arthur C. Clarke is responsible for, you know, coming up with the math that demonstrated the geosynchronous orbit, which is why the, you know, band of satellites that are up there at a certain place is called the Clarke Belt. It is something where, you know, it does not, it's not a requirement that you have to be a particularly, you know, well-versed in science person to write hard science fiction, as they would call it, but it certainly helps. And, you know, there are certainly novelists who write on the extreme edge of hard science fiction where everything has to work and all the math has to work and everything needs to be a real thing. Our most famous recent novel like that is The Martian, and also the novel that that author also just came out with, Project Hail Mary. I mean, you can almost see the math notes in the margins that, you know, guarantee that things are happening. I read a lot of science, blog posts and news stories on the feed to get ideas about what's possible. It's not required in certain realms. I mean, Star Wars, you can certainly be a little bit more fantastic. With Star Trek, I'm a bit more careful. And I do have people that I ask and call upon. I mean, I have a friend, Michael Wong, who's a research associate at the University of Wisconsin. University of Washington. Astrobiology, astronomy department, who, you know, basically whenever I have a crazy idea for what a planet could be, I will go to him and say, is this real? Is this feasible, or have I just made something completely up? And, you know, that's not always a deal breaker. It depends on what kind of realm you're writing about or what kind of pseudoscience you might have that's in play. There's always a little bit of pseudoscience in anything that you're doing. In science fiction, unless you're doing something which is really, you know, supposed to be, almost like a blueprint for something real.
Well, it's really funny that you mentioned that. When you're explaining that in terms of the writers and the scientific minds that some of them have, I go back to Michael Crichton. And Michael Crichton's work, Andromeda Strain and so on, really had that scientific part of it based in science fiction. Yet at the same time, we are experiencing a lot of what's happened, what he wrote about back at that point in time as well.
Michael Crichton is an absolutely wonderful example. I mean, Andromeda Strain, Terminal Man, novels like that, even before you get to Jurassic Park. You even have a movie called Looker, which basically comes up with the whole idea of CGI characters in movies and TV and virtual reality individuals. These are all ideas where somebody took something that they knew about, something they had some information about, and then they just sort of elaborated and extended it on into the future. Where could this technology go? What could happen here? I think that's what people are looking to science fiction for. Fantasy space opera, it's a bit different. I can always tell when I'm writing something, this is more a Star Trek story than a Star Wars story, basically based on how many fantastical elements are in it.
Well, another real-life example happened just last week. NASA launched its first planetary defense mission, the Double Asteroid Redirection Test, or otherwise known as DART. It's an experiment to use a rocket to move a real asteroid off course. And that took me back to the 1998 film Armageddon with Bruce Willis, where an asteroid the size of Texas was on a path to destroy Earth. And the person in charge of the real mission, his title is a planetary defense officer. That was a fictional character back in that day.
Yes.
You know, how does that all...
Well, I was going to say, I prefer to mention Deep Impact, which was the Comet movie that year, which was a little bit better. but, that kind of story, Arthur C. Clarke has a novel also, I think The Hammer of God, I think was the name of it, which was about trying to redirect an asteroid. This is something where, The people who do science fiction have kind of imagined just about every calamity that you can think of. I remember after 9/11, there was talk that the government had gone to some people who did screenwriting and wrote thrillers to try to imagine some of the things where our imagination had failed us. What are some of the worst case scenarios we've never considered? Just in the regular daily world, this is something that science fiction authors are coming up with all the time. What's the most horrible thing we can do? Solar flares? Yeah, we know what to do.
I'd like to dive a little deeper now into the primary universes that you find yourself traveling through: Star Trek, Star Wars, Marvel. Now, each has its own canon. Star Trek, it's the original series. Star Wars, episodes 4, 5, and 6. The Marvel Universe that exists within all this, the same timeline. As a writer, how important is the canon?
Well, I mean, what I've always said is that a story is more than just a chance to connect the dots. A story must stand on its own. So you never want to approach any project saying, hey, I'm going to write the story that will explain how this happened, or where this character got this weapon, or whatever. That can be a springboard at some point in there, but usually you would have come up with something which is about the characters and how they are changed by whatever they're doing. But certainly, having that sort of defined list of characters and locations, settings, technologies that are available, it's really good to be able to consult something. And I do spend a considerable amount of time either on Wikipedia for Star Wars or Memory Alpha for Star Trek, Memory Beta for Star Trek novels and comics. There are these things that are out there. And then, of course, the franchises, the licensing people have their own information as well. They have people who will help you. Star Wars has the Lucasfilm Story Group as well. To sort of guide stories in the proper direction, it does help to be able to have some landmarks and mileposts in the timeline to know, all right, here Star Trek, Picard, Rogue Elements, this is set 1 year after the character Cristobal Rios is kicked off his starship, kicked out of Starfleet, and is set 8 years before the TV series. And here is what is happening here. And here's how many years before this the Romulan star went supernova. You can kind of build outward from each of these things.
So how do your fans keep you on track with that? Do you get a lot of feedback?
In the very first Star Wars comic book that I put out for the Knights of the Old Republic series I did, within hours, there were pages for random characters that I introduced on Wikipedia and on the message boards. There were people saying, hey, you got the year of the start of the Mandalorian War wrong. And it turned out that, kind of I did. And what I did, one of my sayings is, I'm like a baker. If you're baking cookies and cakes, you can eat your mistakes. I try to eat my mistakes and this sort of thing by I figured out a way to actually make my version of the story right and the other version of the story right by this entire first year of the war was the phony war. It wasn't really the real war, but there was still war going on. I do that all the time. I have a slideshow about writing where I'll talk about the seven most powerful words. Oh, yeah, I meant to do that. And then, of course, the slide changes and says the six most powerful words. Oh, yeah, I meant to do that. that is actually a phrase we use a lot when we have the chance to take a mistake and make it part of the story. That's wonderful.
And a little bit of artistic license on top of that as well.
That's right.
We're talking with John Jackson Miller, Central Wisconsin writer who's well-versed in many universes in the galaxies far, far away. You can join the conversation at 800-780-9742. Again, that number is 1-800-780-9742. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. Now, all these in many, many universes that you work in, these are entirely different worlds with their own norms, and really complicated stories. How can someone who isn't really well versed in these cultures find a way in? In other words, do they have to commit to being a dedicated fan, or is it possible to be just to be casual entertainment?
Well, my friend Maggie Thompson, a comic book magazine editor who's been a guest on this program before with me, has often said that every story is someone's first, every comic book is someone's first, every novel is someone's first in a particular universe. I believe that's absolutely true, and I try to write things that, even if it might be in the middle of a storyline in a comic book or something like that, I try to give people, the elements that they need to sort of hit the ground running and understand what's going on. I can say for absolute certain that you need nothing to understand Star Wars Kenobi other than to have seen Star Wars, and even just the first movie is fine. It's just the one in 1977. Star Trek Picard, all you need to do is understand that there is this character, and he will meet Picard someday, and Picard's in the book, and we see how he is. But, as long as you have sort of a vague understanding of, we're not going to explain how transporters work every single book. We're not going to explain how lightsabers work every single book. But we're going to try to make these stories so that you don't have to understand a lot of random different things. One of the things that we did when we wrote Star Wars A New Dawn, which was sort of the first novel in the new era of Star Wars novels that I wrote in 2014, is I stripped out a lot of the gratuitous mentions of corporations and starships and species that people hadn't actually seen on the movie screen. Things that people would not have necessarily been familiar with. Because there is a real temptation in writing science fiction to throw a lot of jargon in and make things seem otherworldly. And the truth is, Star Wars doesn't need help to seem otherworldly. Star Trek doesn't need help to seem otherworldly. I think it's more important for, if you want to have a character do or say something that reflects on the fact that they live in a different universe than we do. You want to try to only use things that if you're going to explain it, explain it. If you're not going to explain it, don't mention it.
What are the common threads that you've seen in your work, Star Trek, Star Wars, and Marvel, between these three main universes that you work right in?
Marvel, my Marvel work goes back to Iron Man, which I did in the early 2000s, and of course Marvel's now reprinting my Star Wars Knights of the Old Republic comics. One of the things that I've seen in all of it is there's an open-ended nature to everything. There is no end in sight for the Star Wars universe, for the Star Trek universe, for the Marvel universe. And one of the things that I've also come to appreciate is that time for the characters is malleable. Because eventually there will be more stories than can fit in Jean-Luc Picard's lifetime. Eventually there will be more stories than can fit in the time in between Star Wars episodes 4 and 5. I think the key more often is, whether it's Marvel or Star Wars or Star Trek, what order do I read the stories in? It's more, we're trying to get this notion that these characters are iconic, these characters are almost mythological. Good luck trying to put any of the James Bond movies in order, or the stories in order. We kind of understand now that it's not something where, there's a rigid, timeline that can be attached to it. This is more about seeing these particular larger-than-life figures, moving about, having these wonderful adventures, and, it not trying to get too bogged down into the minutia, because otherwise that gets very complicated.
Well, what gives a series or a franchise, for that matter, such a really long-standing appeal?
I think having characters that are universal to a degree. There are certainly a lot of characters that you can latch onto and say, okay, I can see myself in this world, or if I was in this world, I would probably be friends with this character or that character. The most important character in Star Wars is Luke Skywalker, who is somebody who grew up on a farm. He's not somebody who grew up at the center of everything. People will say Darth Vader is the most important character. It's the original movies, they say, it's from The Adventures of Luke Skywalker. This is all about him. And so I always try to find an everyman character if I can, or every woman character if I can. My Knights of the Old Republic series is about Zane Carrick, a kid who is the worst Jedi student ever. Anybody who thinks that if I were a Jedi, I'd wash out, well, he's your representative. Anybody who's ever been fired from a job for a reason they don't understand, that's Cristobal Rios and Picard. There are things that cross boundaries from reality to unreality.
John Jackson Miller is our guest today on Route 51 as we continue our voyage through space. When we return, we'll talk about the pandemic's effect on the comics industry and the convention scene. You can join us by calling 800-780-9742, or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. I'm Rick Ryer. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
We're about to buy tickets for Comic-Con.
T-minus 45 seconds.
They sell out incredibly fast, but as long as one of us gets...
Good Lord, this is not the time for flirting. Keep it in your pants.
It's a whole lot of weird before coffee.
We're back on Route 51. I'm Rick Ryer with John Jackson Miller. John's latest book, Star Trek Picard Rogue Elements, is out. Do you have a burning question about Star Trek, Star Wars, or Marvel? What would you like to know about the comics industry, Comic-Con? Email us at ideas@wpr.org or join us by phone. The number is 800-780-9742. Comic-Con, one of the Biggest names and fan conventions went virtual the last 2 years and just had a smaller version of the San Diego Comic-Con last weekend. They appear to be gearing up, John, for an in-person event in 2022. What have fans been saying about that, not only that convention, but other similar conventions around the country?
Well, it was sort of interesting, you know, at the beginning of 2020, sort of being at the beginning of all of this, where, you know, my very last convention was in Richmond, Virginia. You know, March 1st was the last day, and you know, I had a convention planned in 2 weeks later, and that only was canceled the week before, and. You know, it was something where, you know, all through the end of 2020, it was like, well, are we coming back in 2021? And then we got into 2021, and it's like, well, are we coming back? You know, we finally got, as people started getting vaccinated, in the second half of 2021, I did my first convention in Raleigh, North Carolina, at the end of July. And again, just from city to city, it's all dependent on what the local regulations are. You know, Kansas City had a mask ordinance. Hartford, Connecticut, I was in. You actually had to be, proof of vaccination as well. And we were not hearing about any problems, at these locations afterward. Although, certainly, it was a situation where. Some people who did not meet the regulations did have to be turned away, and in fact, one of the dealers I knew of, did not have enough clients to, or not clients, but enough workers to work his booth because, they had not brought their documentation for that. I think that everybody, particularly, we're dealing with the celebrity guests who are there, many of whom are in their 70s, 80s. Everybody is wanting to be as careful as possible. Everyone is wanting to be, protecting folks. I think that we're going to head back into a time where there's an absolute, madhouse where, the fire marshal needs to be called because there are so many people. I still don't think we're going to be at that level for some time. They have been kind of capping the number of people at these events. But there has certainly been a pent-up demand, and one of the things that we found, you mentioned the comics industry, is, because people weren't going to conventions, they were buying the comics online. They were buying from their retailers.
Well, I want to get into that in just a little bit, but I wanted to ask you about that relationship that you have and others that are at these conventions with your readers, with your fans. Talk a little bit about that.
It's just so important to be able, for me, having been locked away writing these books for months at a time, to be able to talk to folks, to be able to actually, show up and hear what they like to see, hear what they like about the books, introduce the books to new folks. I wrote the previous novel, Star Trek Discovery, Die Standing, came out in the middle of the pandemic, and it felt to me like it never came out because I was only doing my first autographs for it in 2021. Of course, it was out. It did well.
Yeah.
It was not a case where I had that personal interaction where I could go talk about it.
Well, that book not only did well, you won the Scribe Award, a fairly major award in your industry.
Yeah, that's from the International Association of Media Tie-In Writers. So that's a panel judged by my peers, the other people that write the books.
And that was for 2021. But, yeah. And you also won that same award for Kenobi.
That's right. That's right. I don't know what it means to get one for Star Wars and one for Star Trek. but I guess it's good to have that validation.
Absolutely. Now, your biography, John, describes you as a comic industry historian. What does that mean?
Well, when I came to Wisconsin, which is, now 28 years ago, it was to be the editor of a magazine for the comic book industry, a magazine called Comics Retailer, which was edited up in Iola, which is where Krause Publications was. That building is now the headquarters of the Iola Car Show that is a big event in the middle of the state every July. I continued to do work, the retail magazine and then also our regular magazine, Comics Buyer's Guide, our consumer magazine, and edit books about comics. This continued, you know, around the time I started writing comics professionally. When I finally quit to, you know, write full time, I decided to start a website called Comicron. It does not rhyme with Omicron. I should say this.
I was worried about that.
No, it's that's Omicron. But Comicron basically ties together comics and chronology, because it is a chronology of all the comics sold in the country and the sales figures for the comics over the years and individual comics. It chronicles all of that. One of the things that it's shown us is that while things were extremely touch and go in the first half of 2020, when the comics industry partially seized up, things are better than we could have imagined.
Well, how has the comic books industry adapted to the COVID-19 pandemic?
Again, we had this problem in the beginning of it where the comics just couldn't get out. One of the printers stopped printing. Diamond Comic Distributors, which is the major distributor, stopped distributing the comics for a few weeks because the stores weren't open to take the books. But what happened is that slowly ramped up. Publishers slowly ramped up in the second half of 2020. What we found is that the back issue market, the collectible market, you know, comics are the magazines that people keep. Comics are the magazines that actually have, you know, in many cases, collectible value. That went really gangbusters. I mean, you know, some of the comics that I signed at the very last convention, that convention I mentioned in the first half of 2020, were being sold for, you know, multiples of what they were originally worth when I looked at the end of 2020 on eBay. These things are, you know, people have this pent-up, demand for, the things that they love to collect, and they weren't able to travel, they weren't able to go to conventions, and so, they ended up putting that money into collectibles, they put that money into comics, we are glad to get back to, you know, at least a limited slate of conventions now, I think still there's going to be that dynamic. The sales figures for comics in 2021 are better than they were before the pandemic. The head of Diamond Comic Distributors said in an interview yesterday that the number of comic shops that have opened is larger than the number that have closed during the pandemic.
Wow.
This is all a good thing.
Well, how was the writing process different between writing a book, a novel, versus writing for comics? And how do you collaborate with the artist to let the visuals tell the story in the comic?
Well, very frequently, you're not in the same country with the artist. So, there's not a lot of collaboration on that side. You write a complete script, and so the artist works on that. But I'm actually working with a friend of mine, James Mishler, on a comics project at the moment. He and I are, even though we're both in Wisconsin, we're communicating via the same sharing, programs that people use for other things.
Zoom.
Documents that pass back and forth. Where we'll sit on the phone or sit on the device or whatever and debate what we're working on. The particular project has not been announced yet, but I guess I mentioned that we're doing it. It's something where the ability to collaborate, when being in different places is much changed. These are tools that I have never used in many cases. You're learning more about them all the time.
Well, you brought on an example of your past work, which is now re-released in this 7.5-pound volume, Knights of the Old Republic. Talk a little bit about that project.
Okay, the Knights of the Old Republic series was the series that I wrote for Dark Horse Comics, the previous licensor for adult Star Wars comics. 2006 is when it began, and this series went on for 5 years, and it chronicled the adventures of Zane Carrick, this kid who was accused of a crime he didn't commit, and the storyline is about him trying to clear his name and then also helping the people that helped him along the way. A 1,344-page volume that Marvel put out in the month of July. It has everything I ever wrote for. It's all 57 issues, including the handbook that had previously not been reprinted by Dark Horse, including the text pages that I wrote that were sort of in-universe news stories that sort of are interstitials in between some of the stories. All this is in there, just a very wonderful product, and weighs, as you say, 7.5 pounds because it is oversized. Two different covers, one by Brian Ching, the guy who created the looks of the characters. Another by Dustin Weaver, who is one of Marvel's top artists right now. Again, I'm just really happy that Marvel put this out. It is a delightful collection.
It's really a beautiful piece. Now, you referred earlier in the program that, you know, back in the 2000s, you created a character, Sonny Birch, for Iron Man.
Yeah.
Birch, he made his Marvel Cinema debut in Ant-Man and the Wasp in 2018. And before that, you created a character, Christine Everhart, who was the first in the first Iron Man film in 2008. I guess these would be considered side characters. Given the opportunity, would there be a major Marvel character you'd like to write?
There's a lot of characters that would be fun to write. A lot of characters would be fun to write. I wrote Captain America as just he has a cameo in my Iron Man comics. Certainly it would be fun to write him in something more substantial. It's fun having these characters in the shows, though. I was driving my kid to college, started getting text messages that, John, you're in What If? And I said, what? I didn't write anything for What If. And it turned out that the Christine Everhart character appears in both the Doctor Strange episode and the Iron Man Killmonger episodes of What If. And so I'm in the back of those. Again, just wonderful to kind of have that there.
Now, there's quite a few films coming out in theaters and streaming services this month and into this next year, Spider-Man, No Way Home, and The Book of Boba Fett, and so on. What are you most looking forward to?
Looking forward to, the Spider-Man was, of course, just as a fan. Yeah. Like writing Spider-Man someday, too, that'd be a blast. But the big one that's coming out in 2022 or sometime, we don't know exactly when, is going to be the Kenobi show. That's the Ewan McGregor TV series that will be on, the Disney Plus service. There's no set date for it, but that I'm aware of. And if I knew, I wouldn't be able to say.
That's true. And speaking of which, of things you might not be able to talk about, you recently tweeted about Dark Horse Comics starting a new line of all-ages Star Wars comics and graphic novels this next year. Can you give us any details?
That's a thing where Marvel was doing the adult comics for Star Wars. A company called IDW was doing the kids comics. I did a kids comic for them called the Star Wars Adventures Annual in 2018, where it was actually the first time I had written Luke and Leia and the droids in any Star Wars anything in this children's story. What has happened is that Dark Horse has got the license for those kids comics back. It's sort of nice to have that logo associated with Star Wars again.
In the last 30 seconds or so of the program today, John, what's on the horizon for you?
I've got a lot of writing to do. I've got many projects that I just cannot discuss. But certainly, folks can follow me on social media. JJM Faraway is my Twitter. And I have these books out, Rogue Elements, the Old Republic Omnibus. There's also a couple of books out from a company called Titan, the Star Wars Fiction Collections. These are hardcovers that have short stories that appeared in their magazine, Star Wars Short Stories, and I've got a couple of those in there.
Anything that you haven't done yet that you'd like to do?
Oh, there's a variety of things.
one thing?
There's a variety of things. People are always asking me, what's the license you wish you had written about? And I say, I'd love to write things for TV shows that nobody would actually pay me to write for. So that's one thing that I am toying with is writing for television at some point.
Oh, and, terrific!
I'm going to look into that in the 13th hour of the of my 12-hour day.
There you go. John Jackson Miller, thank you so much for being with us today on Route 51. You can follow John online at firewaypress.com. I'm Rick Ryer, glad to have listeners of the West Side along for the ride today. Our producer today is Joy Ratchkramer. Joy is also our on-air producer. Special music today from Jeff Russo, Styx, John Williams, and Samuel King. Kim, thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. You can hear the archive of today's program at route51.wpr.org/route51. Next week, Shireen Seward is back, and special guest Randy Sabine sharing music of the holidays and stories as well. Until then, we're headed out of town.